When most of us think about the economy, we picture something like a giant house.
Right.
And in that house, there's just this single thermostat on the wall. We call it the interest rate.
Yeah, the magical dial.
Exactly. And we tend to imagine the Federal Reserve, walking up to that wall, turning the dial up a few degrees to cool things down, or turning it down to heat things up. And we just assume that whatever number they set that dial to, well, the whole house feels it in the exact same way.
Which is, I mean, it's a very comforting linear way to look at the world. You
Yeah.
know, one dial, one temperature, one shared reality across the entire financial system.
But today, for you listening, our mission is to completely shatter that illusion.
Yeah.
Because we're doing a deep dive into a really dense, but honestly fascinating 2026 strategy report.
Yeah, it's a great one.
It was published by the American newspaper and American TV, and it's titled Hedge Funds and Interest Rates.
Yeah.
And the very first thing this report does is rip that thermostat right off the wall.
Just completely dismantles it.
Oh, right. It tells us that for the people actually moving trillions of dollars around, the interest rate as a singular thing doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, the premise they establish right out of the gate is that for Wall Street hedge funds, interest rates are actually a multi-layered operating system.
Okay, an operating system.
Yeah, you can't just look at the Fed target, that's merely an anchor. To run a fund or, you know, to genuinely understand market behavior, you are monitoring policy rates, SOFR, repo funding, real rates, and the entire yield curve.
All at the same time.
Simultaneously,
Right.
it isn't a thermostat. It's more like the control room of a nuclear submarine where pulling one lever physically alters the tension on every other lever.
A control room. I like that visual. But before we start flipping switches and, dismantling this engine to see how it works,
Right.
we need to talk about the road
The
conditions.
environment we're actually in.
Exactly, because this report is specifically a 2026 reality check. And the 2026 landscape is an interesting beast. The Fed target range is sitting at 3.50% to 3.75%. And the report also mentions the Treasury curve is upward sloping once you get past the front end. Actually, wait, I'm going to stop you right there. What exactly is the front end, and why does it matter if the curve is sloping upward?
Well, that's a crucial starting point. When we talk about the yield curve, we're simply mapping out how much interest the government pays to borrow money for different lengths of time.
Okay.
So the front end refers to short-term borrowing, you know, things like 1 month or 6 month treasury bills.
Got it.
Usually, if you lock your money up for 10 years, you expect to be paid a higher interest rate than if you lock it up for a month, right? Because there's more time for things to go wrong.
Makes sense.
That creates an upward slope. Now, for the last few years, we had an inverted curve where short-term rates were strangely higher than long-term ones. But in 2026, the report notes we've normalized.
Okay, so the slope is going up again past those short-term rates. Okay, that makes sense. So we have this normalized curve, we have rates around 3.50% to 3.75%, and we have hedge fund capital sitting massive at over $5.22 trillion. I mean, trillion with a T.
Yeah, it's a staggering amount of money. And that $5.22 trillion figure indicates that allocator demand, so pension funds, endowments, is incredibly strong.
You're just throwing money at these funds.
They are because they want strategies that are liquid, flexible, and supposedly unconnected to whether the stock market is just going up or down. But, you know, that massive pool of capital is navigating a high carry, positive real rate environment now.
Which brings me to a phrase in this report that I can't get out of my head. It argues that this current rate environment punishes lazy leverage.
Yes, that's a key takeaway.
When I read that, it hit me. This is basically like bowling. Like if you think about the zero rate environment of the 2010s, it feels like bowling with the bumpers up.
Oh, the bumpers are a great way to visualize the lack of consequence.
Right. You could throw the ball terribly. You could have a sloppy trade, bad timing, terrible risk management. But because borrowing money was essentially free, the bumpers kept your ball in the lane.
You still knock down some pins.
Yeah, and you looked like a pro. The zero interest rate covered up all the mistakes. But now, at 3.50% to 3.75%, the bumpers are gone.
The bumpers are absolutely gone. And the report is explicit about the consequences of throwing a gutter ball today.
Right.
When you have high borrowing costs, genuine skill is heavily rewarded. But lazy leverage strategies that solely depend on having a cheap balance sheet in artificially calm markets is severely punished.
Okay, so if the bumpers are gone, people must be throwing gutter balls right now. Like, who is bleeding the most in this environment? What's the trap door?
Well, the authors point to one specific area as the most dangerous crowded engine on Wall Street, and that's highly levered treasury basis and swap spread trades.
Okay.
Specifically, the ones financed through repo markets without robust stress liquidity.
Whoa, hold on. You just threw a massive wall of Wall Street jargon at me. Highly levered treasury basis trade. Break down the mechanics of that for me because I have no idea what that looks like in practice.
Fair enough. Let's strip away the jargon. Imagine you are looking at a cash treasury bond and a treasury futures contract.
Okay, two different things.
But they fundamentally represent the same underlying asset. But because of market quirks, they might trade a tiny, tiny fraction of a penny apart.
Oh, like finding the exact same TV at two different stores, but for a $1 difference.
Precisely. So you buy the cheaper one, you sell the expensive one, and you wait for the prices to converge. You lock in a guaranteed profit.
It seems simple enough.
It is, but because the price difference is microscopic, making a $1 profit isn't going to satisfy a multi-billion dollar hedge fund, you know?
Yeah, they want the big bucks.
Right. So to make real money, you have to do this on a massive scale. You need to borrow billions of dollars in cash to amplify that tiny trade.
So you're borrowing an absurd amount of money to pick up pennies in front of a steamroller. Where are you getting billions of dollars in cash?
In the repo market. The repurchase agreement market.
Okay.
It's essentially a giant pawn shop for banks and hedge funds. The fund hands over their treasury bonds as collateral, and the lender hands them cash for a very short period, often just overnight.
So they pawn the bonds to get cash.
Exactly. The danger and the reason the report issues such a stark warning is what happens when a shock hits.
Like if the market freaks out over an inflation report or, I don't know, a geopolitical event.
Exactly. Suddenly liquidity dries up. Your prime broker, the one lending you the money, gets nervous.
Right.
They look at your mountain of borrowed cash and say, I need more collateral today, or I am selling your positions to protect myself.
A margin call.
A massive margin call. And if you are levered 50-1 and you don't have a giant pile of backup cash sitting around what the report calls stress liquidity, you are forced to sell your positions at the exact worst possible second.
Which drives the price down even further.
Exactly, triggering more margin calls for everyone else.
Wow. Which perfectly explains why the author of this report has such a, well, a blunt conclusion for anyone trying to start a new fund today. They literally write, do not launch a fixed income arbitrage platform unless you have massive institutional prime brokerage infrastructure. Like, don't even try it.
Yeah, the barrier to entry has moved significantly. They suggest an emerging manager is much safer, starting with a liquid global macro strategy, or CTA.
CTA.
A commodity trading advisor strategy.
Okay, why are those safer?
Because they don't require squeezing microscopic pennies out of the market. A global macro fund, or CTA, is generally looking to ride directional trends.
Like bigger movements.
Yeah, like betting that the yen will weaken over 6 months or oil prices will rise. Because the price movements they are targeting are much larger, they don't need 50 times leverage just to generate a return.
Right, so they aren't held hostage by the overnight repo market to the same extreme degree. Okay, so we've established why the stakes are so high right now. But to understand how funds actually navigate this submarine control room, we have to look at the taxonomy of rates, the specific dials they are watching.
And this is where we move from the macroeconomic theory to the actual plumbing of the financial system.
Right. And the report highlights a few key ones.
Mm-hmm.
There is SOFR, the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, sitting at 3.60%, which it calls the core benchmark for derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
There are repo rates, which we just talked about, acting as the lifeblood of these relative value trades. But here's where it gets really interesting to me. Normal people, you and me, we only look at nominal rates, like the sticker price.
Mm.
If a mortgage is 6%, it's 6%.
Yeah.
But the report really hammers home this concept of real rates.
The distinction between nominal and real rates is arguably the pivot point for all modern valuation.
I was trying to wrap my head around this.
Yeah.
It's kind of like looking at a pay stub. Where the nominal rate is my gross pay to the big exciting number printed at the top, but the real rate is what actually hits my bank account after taxes and inflation.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
It's what I actually get to take to the grocery store.
The grocery store analogy captures the mechanics perfectly. Nominal yields are the raw percentage before adjusting for inflation. Real rates are the inflation-adjusted yields.
Right.
On Wall Street, they track these using TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. And the report notes that right now, real discount rates are meaningfully positive. For example, the 10-year real rate is sitting around 2.16%.
Okay, so a positive real rate of 2.16%. Why is that specific number so crucial? Why does the report treat real rates like a secret decoder ring?
Well, it comes down to how investors value the future. Think about massive tech companies or AI stocks. These are long-duration assets.
You're right.
Their current stock price is heavily based on massive profits they projected make 5, 10, or 15 years from now.
Because they're building the infrastructure of the future, so you're buying the dream of tomorrow's dominance.
Exactly. But you have to discount that future dream back to today's dollars. If the real rate, the safe, inflation-adjusted return you can get right now just by holding a boring government bond is 2.16%, suddenly those future AI profits look a lot less attractive.
Oh, because I could just get a safe return now.
Right. The opportunity cost of waiting 10 years is simply too high. It forces the market to demand stronger, immediate earnings evidence. You can't just sell a 10-year vision. You have to show the cash flow today.
That clicks for me, because if I can get a guaranteed 2.16% real return risk-free, my hurdle for taking a risk on your tech startup is so much higher.
Yeah.
And this must affect commodities too, right? Like gold.
Very directly. Gold doesn't pay a yield. It doesn't pay a dividend.
It just sits there.
Yeah. So when real rates are high, holding a block of gold actually costs you money in terms of the interest you are missing out on. High real rates create intense competition between holding cash and holding real assets.
All right, so we've mapped the taxonomy. Okay. SOFR, repo, real rates. But knowing the names of the parts doesn't explain how the engine actually breaks down.
No, it doesn't.
Which brings us to the transmission mechanism. How do these specific rates physically translate into a hedge fund making or losing money on a Tuesday afternoon?
Well, the report details several transmission channels. The most immediate one is financing costs. This acts as the true hurdle rate for any fund using borrowed money.
The math here gets brutal fast.
Yeah.
Like if we stick to regular business terms, think of financing costs, like shipping costs.
Okay.
Let's say you're selling a product and your profit margin, your expected alpha, is 80 basis points. Oh. And just as a quick reminder for you listening, a basis point is 0.01%. So 80 basis points is under 1%.
Correct.
So if your expected return is 80 basis points and your shipping cost, your funding spread is only 25 basis points, you have a great business. You're netting 55.
It's a solid trade.
But if the cost of borrowing spikes and suddenly your funding is 125 basis points, your exact same trade with the exact same 80 basis point profit margin is now bankrupting you.
The trade idea itself didn't fail. The cost to hold the trade failed. That is the mechanical reality of leverage. And it entirely shifts the behavior of the people who hand over the $5.22 trillion, the allocators.
Right, because if I'm managing a university endowment, I don't have to give my money to a hedge fund.
You don't. The report points out that with the interest on reserve balances, the IORB, sitting at 3.65%, cash is a highly competitive asset class.
You can just sit on the cash.
Exactly. Allocators can sit in cash and earn a meaningful risk-free return. They are no longer tolerant of funds that try to fake performance by using hidden leverage.
Right.
They demand true alpha actual skill in picking mispriced assets because market beta minus high borrowing costs is a losing formula.
Now here's the transmission channels from the report that completely threw me off. It talks about short position rebates.
Ah, yes.
When I hear high interest rates, my brain immediately thinks bad for the market, bad for stocks.
Yeah.
But the report states high rates actually benefit short sellers.
Mm.
Mechanically, how is that possible?
It's one of the most counterintuitive operational details in finance. Let's walk through the steps of shorting a stock.
Okay, let's do it.
First, a hedge fund borrows shares of a company they think will go down. Second, they immediately sell those borrowed shares into the open market.
Okay, so now the fund has a pile of cash from that sale, but they still owe the shares to whoever they borrowed them from.
Correct. But that pile of cash doesn't just sit under a mattress. It sits in an account at their prime broker. And the prime broker pays the hedge fund interest on that cash.
What?
This is called the short rebate.
Wait, really? So the fund is earning daily interest on cash they generated by selling an asset they don't even own?
Yes.
That is insane.
In the 2010s, when short-term rates were zero, that rebate was practically non-existent. But with rates at 3.60%, that cash pile is generating significant risk-free income for the fund every single day.
Wow.
Even if the stock price does absolutely nothing, the fund is making money just off the interest.
Just for sitting there.
Yeah. Now, the report adds a necessary caveat. If a stock is heavily shorted, the broker will charge a hard-to-borrow fee, which can eat up that rebate. But structurally, high rates fundamentally improve the economics of a liquid short book.
That is wild.
Yeah.
It just proves that every single dial in this control room affects a completely different part of the ship. And there's another channel they mentioned that goes back to our dangerous trade discussion. Margin calls and repo haircuts. Give me an example of a haircut breaking a trade.
Sure. A haircut is the buffer a lender requires to protect themselves. If you want to borrow money using a $100 treasury bond as collateral, the lender won't give you $100. They might give you $98.
Okay.
That $2 difference is the haircut.
It's their safety net in case the bond drops in value.
Exactly. But if rate volatility suddenly spikes, meaning prices are swinging wildly or lenders panic, they might suddenly demand a $5 haircut instead of $2.
Oh, I see.
So if you are fully maxed out on borrowed money, your broker suddenly tells you, I need $3 in cash for every bond you hold immediately.
And if you don't have it?
That microscopic change in the haircut forces funds to liquidate their portfolios just to meet the margin call.
So the bumpers are down and the lane is covered in ice.
That's one way to put it, yeah.
Which brings us to the human element. Because this transmission chain is so ridiculously complex, you can't just have one person watching the thermostat. The report actually details how different actors within the exact same hedge fund view the exact same interest rate movement differently.
We see a very rigid division of labor. The CIO, the portfolio manager, the risk manager, the prime broker, they are all asking completely different questions about the same event.
The report has this standout quote. The difference between an amateur and a professional rate view is operational detail. Amateurs simply look at their screens and say, rates up, stocks down. Let's walk through the pros, starting with the CIO. What is the chief investment officer looking at?
The CIO is looking at the macro regime. They aren't trading individual bonds. They are managing the firm's total capital. If the Fed cuts rates, the amateur cheers. But the CIO asks, why are they cutting? Are they cutting because inflation is beaten and we achieved a soft landing? If so, buy risk assets.
But what's the alternative?
Or are they cutting because the economy is plunging into a recession?
Ah, because if it's a recession, corporate defaults are going to spike, which means the CIO needs to sell corporate bonds and buy safe treasuries. Even if the absolute rate is dropping, the why dictates the action.
Precisely. Now, zoom in to the portfolio manager, the PM. They are focused entirely on the micro.
The day-to-day.
Yeah. The report notes they're looking for mispricing after adjusting for their specific funding costs. They are analyzing the carry, the roll-down, and the borrow costs.
Okay, define carry and roll-down for me in this context.
Carry is simply the yield you earn while holding the bond minus what it costs to fund it. If the bond pays 5% and your loan costs 3%, your carry is 2%.
Simple enough.
Roll-down is a bit more complex. As a bond gets closer to its maturity date, its price typically moves toward its face value. So rolling down the yield curve means capturing that predictable price appreciation over time.
Okay, got it.
The PM's job is optimizing those tiny mathematical advantages.
And while the PM is trying to squeeze out those pennies, the risk manager is playing the ultimate game of what if.
Oh, absolutely. The risk manager assumes the worst. They don't care if the PM's trade is theoretically profitable on paper. They care about what breaks under a correlated shock.
Like the margin calls we talked about.
Right. If funding costs spike at the exact moment asset prices drop, do we have enough cash buffer to survive? Will the prime broker increase our haircuts? They are running stress tests on the P&L and mapping liquidity horizons.
And finally, there's the prime broker themselves acting as the gatekeeper. They look at the fund's collateral and decide, how much balance sheet and financing spread should I actually allow this client to have? It's a web of dependencies. And it perfectly illustrates that quote. When an amateur sees a headline that says, the Fed raises rates by 25 basis points, they might just panic and sell their index fund. But a professional has a whole checklist.
And that checklist sounds like a foreign language to the outside world, Gar asking. Was the move driven by nominal yields or real yields? Did the yield curve bull flatten or bear steepen?
Okay, bull flatten sounds like a rodeo term.
Yeah.
What does a yield curve flattening actually look like in the real world?
Well, a bull flatten happens when long-term interest rates fall faster than short-term interest rates.
Okay.
The curve gets flatter. It's called bull because falling rates mean bond prices are going up, which is a bull market for bonds.
Right.
Usually this happens when the market anticipates the economy is slowing down and expects the Fed to cut rates eventually, even if short-term rates are still high right now. The checklist is about diagnosing the underlying disease, not just reading the thermometer.
Wow. Okay, let's bring this all together. We started this deep dive with the illusion of the thermostat, the idea that the economy is a house with a single dial.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've seen from this 2026 strategy report is that Wall Street operates in a massive, multi-layered submarine control room.
It's incredibly complex.
Yeah, it's an operating system built on SOFR, on overnight repo markets, on real rates crushing future tech valuations, and on the split-second operational decisions of CIOs and risk managers trying to survive without the bumpers.
Understanding that operating system is the key to demystifying the financial news. It explains why things that seem completely paradoxical to the average person, like high rates actually generating huge profits for short sellers, or a simple margin haircut triggering a billion-dollar liquidation, make total mathematical sense once you see the plumbing.
So for you listening, the next time you are scrolling through your feed and you see a massive headline screaming, "The Fed changes rates," mm-hmm. you now have the tools to look under the hood.
Yeah, you really do.
You don't have to be the amateur who just says, "Rates up, stocks down." You will know to ask the mechanical questions. What are the funding costs? What shape is the yield curve taking? And most importantly, what are the real rates actually doing to the market?
You'll be looking at the groceries you can actually buy, not just the gross paycheck.
I love that. But, you know, going through all this incredible operational detail leaves me with a somewhat uncomfortable thought.
Oh, yeah.
Something I want to leave you, the listener, to mull over on your own time. Mm-hmm. If the difference between an amateur and a professional is really just this massive, complex web of operational detail mm-hmm. and having access to specialized prime brokerage firms and repo markets, are retail investors fundamentally playing a game they can never actually win?
Well, the disparity in tools is massive, that's for sure.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, does the sheer insane complexity of this hedge fund operating system make these mega funds secretly more fragile? Like, couldn't an unpredictable correlated black swan event shatter that submarine control room faster than it affects an average person who is just holding a simple, unlevered index fund?
It's the ultimate paradox of sophisticated finance. The same complex machinery that allows them to squeeze alpha out of the market also exposes them to catastrophic breaking points that the average investor just doesn't have to worry about.
Maybe sometimes you're better off just sitting in the living room trusting a thermostat rather than trying to wire the nuclear control room yourself. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.